Welcome to Mental Toughness with Dr. Rob Bell. Each week, Dr. Rob sits down with athletes, executives, and expert coaches to talk about mental toughness and their hinge moment. Here's your host, Dr. Rob.
Well, I think that Ted Lasso's superpower is, he's got great human relations skills, but the superpower with that is he doesn't think he has all the answers and he's willing to listen to his players.
So our guest today is a friend. We both attended Temple University and we've stayed connected over the years. At different times, though, however, he's much, much older than I am. He is a performance consultant, coach, author, speaker. He's written several books, Seeds of Success, Stadium Status, and The Coach Approach, and then also wrote Beyond Stadium Status, among other books, which we will delve into today. One of these is The Big Book of Brew, which is actually a smaller book, and the book he's reading right now, The Lasso Way, as you can see it here. He also created Chin Up, Chest Out. You can find him on coachbrew.com. Our guest is John Brubaker. John, man, it's been, I think, too long, but thanks for coming on, man, and taking the time, bud.
Thank you. Great to be back, Rob.
So let's talk about Twitter for a second. X, sorry.
Yes.
You have a fantastic sense of humor on Twitter. I know this is a vague question, but where do you get off on just being so funny on X?
So first off, I think I ought to have you tell that to my wife, because my wife does not find me in the least bit humorous on social media.
Really?
Specifically not on Twitter. Because every now and then I vent my frustrations. But I try and do so in a fairly innocuous way, you know, unless it involves just utter wasting of our tax dollars by the government. That's probably my biggest beef that I vent about that frustrates her. But, you know, I just I try and find humor in everyday life. You know, the other day I was waiting in line at Starbucks and there were like a group of three or four co-eds talking, and one of them asked the other if they've ever been to Kauai, and they said, no, I've never left the country. I just literally hit record on my phone. I'm just standing there like holding my phone out as if I'm like just scrolling, but I'm just recording it because like truth is stranger than fiction. And then I tweeted the conversation, and you can go back and look at it, but it's just humor in everyday life, because I think, you know, some things are so either dark or frustrating that if we don't find humor in it, it can get depressing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I try and spin things maybe to a positive if I can.
Talk to us. Let's start with your coaching career, man.
Sure.
How you got into college coaching, and start us from there, and then kind of like your experience with it. And then I'll kind of lead it from there, but start to us about that, man.
Yeah. So I was in grad school at Temple University in 1993. And, you know, I always thought like I would want to be a youth lacrosse coach. I was a college lacrosse player at Fairleigh Dickinson University. And I caught the coaching bug, so I just coached like a youth team, rec league type thing, and you know, in the evenings or weekends after school. And then somebody approached me about, somebody I ran into on the field, you know, after a game, just happened to be out there, approached me about, you know, a college position that was available at his college that he attended, college kid. And it was at Cabrini University in Philadelphia. And I, you know, I just thought, hey, you know, I always think like anything is probably worth a phone call. You have those hinge moments. This is probably one of them. Anything's worth a phone call. So I just called and inquired, and I, hey, I wonder what this would be like. And went in for an interview. That's where I met my coaching mentor, He offered me a position. It was a very unique, unorthodox interview. That would be another whole podcast episode. But basically, you know, this older, disheveled man shows up at the door. I'm dressed in like a coat and tie. And he said, "You ever line a field?" And I'm like, "No, sir." He said, "Well, you're going to today." And I was grossly overdressed for what turned out to be the interview. But the guy basically was kind of playing dumb. You know, "Hey, oh, I forgot the paint. Can you go back into the storage shed and get the paint?" And then he would, you know how you line a field, you take two stakes with a string to make like the sideline. He would hold it like really crooked and just see if I would tell him, "Hey, you need to move it over a couple inches to the right," or if I would just accept things at face value, not question authority, not put attention to detail into my work. Like, I didn't realize that was the interview. But, you know, I tried to coach him up a little and you know, make some adjustments there. And he offered me the job. And that's really when I got the coaching bug. And I decided that's what I wanted to make my career. I didn't want to be a sports psychologist. I didn't want to be like on the clinical side, sitting, you know, as a psychologist, sitting in an office, hearing other people's problems all day. You know, I wanted to be out recruiting and coaching and teaching. And that, you know, led me down a 12-year career path. But the funny part, to bring that full circle, is when I became a head coach, I called my mentor, Randy, and I said, "Hey, I'm interviewing an assistant coach candidate for, you know, my assistant job. You know, what do you recommend? What questions do you think I ought to ask the guy?" He's like, "Questions? You know, just take him out and have him line a field with you. That'll tell you everything you need to know about him." So, like, I had no idea that the interview and the questions and the test was just helping him line an athletic field. When I was
not until you asked him.
Yep.
Did you put it together? Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of like Yoda. There's very much a Yoda-like quality about him, and it wasn't always endearing. Sometimes it was frustrating, but there's just like an awful lot of wisdom there if you could use discernment and extract it. And that turned into me being a coach for 12 years. I had a wonderful career, but, you know, I think like all things, your career is a shelf life, and I was burning the candle at both ends and ended up getting out 12 years later. I was just burnt out.
So I want to ask you about, you know, a couple mountaintop moments and then sort of like coming off that mountaintop and what one of those valleys were, because that was a hinge moment as well. Your mess becomes your message. But back to the lining of the field. I mean, it kind of reminds me of, I think, what was it like JP Morgan, if he was hiring an executive, would take him out to lunch and he wanted to see if they put salt on their food. Cause if he put salt on their food before they even tried it, he wouldn't hire them, because that would show them that they were rash and rushed to judgment. It was sort of like the last litmus test. But I mean, that seems what your coach did in that circumstance was sort of like a lunch test.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of little tests that people use. I've heard the one about JP Morgan. The other that I really like, you know, that I used was, you go on a home visit with a recruit and their parents. Like, how do they treat their mom? Are they respectful to their mom? Are they respectful to their dad? If they are, great, we can continue the conversation. If they're not, if you can't be respectful to your parents, you're not going to be respectful to your teachers and coaches. Yeah, that was a deal breaker for me, but that was another one of those little tests. Yeah.
Hey, good looking. If you like this podcast and are already a badass, but it's all way too complicated, then visit our website, drrobbell.com, and schedule a call with us to help capture your very own hinge moment.
So talk to us, what was a mountaintop moment as a lacrosse coach?
I think a lot of mountaintop moments are just getting a kid through school that maybe you took a chance on, couldn't have gotten in on their own merit, but fortunately they had athletic ability. And you had to go to bat for them with admissions, and, you know, that bet ended up paying off, and they just had an opportunity to shine. So, you know, beyond the field, that's probably every time that happened, that's a mountaintop moment, in my opinion. You know, I didn't coach Division One. I was at the small college level where you're teaching classes and coaching and fundraising and doing 20 other things to justify the peanuts they paid you. So, you know, it was, everything's always about the relationships for me. You know, sure, we won some championships, went to the NCAA Final Four in 2002. I had All-Americans, academic All-Americans, like that was all great. But at the end of the day, you know, I think you're in the relationship business in whatever you do. And for me, you know, the mountaintop moments are always in the relationships.
Yeah.
And that's with anything. You could take out coaching and insert any other profession.
Sure. Coach Brew, you talked about in your book, you know, your mess being your message, which I love that line as well. You were fired on your birthday.
Yep.
Talk to us about that experience. How that
strange, strange mountaintop moment. So
that wasn't a valley. That was a mountaintop moment.
Strangely, I thought it was a valley. It was actually a mountaintop. So the irony of that whole situation was we had just, I had just come off a year earlier, you know, our best season in program history, went to the NCAA Final Four, finished up third in the country, lost the eventual national champions. And a year later, you know, my athletic director walked in my office and it's the end of the season. And we had like I think we finished 7-9. You know, we had graduated 120 points from the year before. Like we were young,
right?
But we were on a good path and we had a great recruiting class. He just said, "Hey, John, do you have a minute?" And I said, "Sure, come on in, have a seat." He's like, "Oh, it's okay. It won't take that long." And so I just got out of a meeting with the president of the college and we came to the conclusion there's only one thing keeping us from winning a national championship in lacrosse. So here I am thinking, okay, finally, I'm going to get the 10.8 full scholarships that everybody else in our league had. We were at, you know, four forever. Or I was going to get a full-time assistant. I had a part-time assistant who got $4,000 room and board. And that was it. Like, you can't compete without the resources. So I'd been very vocal about lobbying for and asking for, you know, upgrades and scholarship and staff. So I'm wondering, like, you know,
you're coming off meeting with the president. AD comes in, says
the AD met with the president and says that.
Okay.
And now in my mind, I'm wondering, which is it going to be? Am I getting a full-time assistant? Am I getting these scholarships? Hell, maybe I'm getting both. And he said that one thing that's keeping us from winning a national championship in men's lacrosse is you. We're making a change. And he takes out of his coat pocket, he takes an envelope out, passes it across my desk, and walks out. In the envelope was a pink slip, the proverbial pink slip. And they were kind enough to give me a whopping 3-month severance, reneged on the final month, because by then they had hired somebody else. And that happened on my birthday. Now, the real irony of that is, my athletic director, who will remain nameless, we'll just call him Carl, because that's his name. famous for remembering people's birthdays. We'd have an emergency staff meeting, air quotes, you know, on like a Tuesday at lunchtime, and he'd call the whole staff in, and then he'd roll in on like one of those AV carts. He'd roll in a big sheet cake for whoever's birthday it was that week. Presents, cards, that kind of thing. He was great with remembering people's birthdays. And, you know, I definitely got a birthday present. It wasn't an actual tangible present that you would, you know, unwrap the box and open up. It was a gift. And that gift was perspective, because I was burning the candle at both ends. I was kind of taking a flamethrower to it, sleeping in the office some nights. My oldest daughter had just been born a week before the season started. I was out the door before she was up. I didn't get home at night until after she was in bed. I didn't see her for the first, you know, the 4 months of her life, essentially. I had to hit pause and find some balance and some perspective. And it ended up being the best possible thing for me. personally and professionally. I just didn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm. So at the time it was the worst, but it ended up becoming the best.
Yep. Now it took a while to get there. So I say it was a mountaintop moment, but that's only connecting the dots backwards.
Right. Well said. Well, talk to us about like, what was that progression like? I mean, how did that become then a best moment?
Full disclosure, I was clinically depressed. You know, I was just literally like sitting in my living room chair from the time I got up in the morning, you know, straight through the whole work day. I had nowhere to be.
Like after you got fired?
Yeah, after I got fired, just sitting at home. And, you know, my wife would come home and I think it was like day five. She just looked at me. She's like, you can sit there as long as you want, but you're starting to stink up the living room. At least go take a shower and change your clothes. And so I did that. I decided I need to talk to somebody I didn't live with about what was going on. So I sought out a therapist. Five stars, highly recommend. I think everybody ought to be in therapy at some point in their life, some way, shape, or form. And therapist encouraged me to keep a journal. So I just literally started journaling, you know, my thoughts, my feelings, and that morphed into just journaling about the parallels between, you know, sports, leadership in sports, my time, you know, 12 years prior as a coach, and just sort of how that translates into, quote, the real world outside of college athletics and academia. And, you know, a couple months in, I ended up getting a job working on air for ESPN Radio, which is, you know, kind of like working in America's toy department, the toy department of life, as I would call it. And that's when I really started speaking about it more, writing about it, and it turned into a journal, actually turned into my first book, The Coach Approach. But yeah, so that was kind of the process right after getting fired and just kind of, you know, it's what happens to you versus how you respond to what happens to you. And I don't think that's something, you know, something that big and traumatic, like that's one of the top five major life events anyone can have, you know, getting married, moving, job change, funeral, and I forget the fifth one, but it's pretty traumatic. And I don't think you get through it alone. So, you know, I'd encourage anybody going through anything like that, any kind of major life transition, find some help. Could be a coach, could be a therapist, could just be, you know, a close mentor that you can lean on.
Yeah. Because I always say there are two types of coaches, right? Those that have been fired and then those that eventually will be fired.
And if you don't think you're going to fall into category number two, like give it a little more time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, coaches are hired to be fired at every level. You know, I coached a minor sport, small college level, and I got fired for, you know, not winning enough.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen, you know, in a minor sport, the small college level. It can happen anywhere.
You know, I want to talk about The Last Away, but then the Book of Brew, big book.
Sure.
Of Brew. But first, I wanted to ask, like, you know, 2019, pre-pandemic, and that's how life is now, right? And it's pre-pandemic or post-pandemic. That's how it is for
me. BC and AD, isn't it? Yeah.
BC and AD, got it, man. Yeah. And so, but in 2019, I mean, you had injury, and then, you know, the mental injuries then took place, took its toll on you. You've shared about that, but can you share your experience?
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate you asking that. Most people don't go there, so I appreciate you going there. I had a pretty significant neck injury, pinched nerve in my neck. I couldn't lift my arm like up above my shoulder. And you know, I was going to need spinal fusion surgery. Fortunately, I narrowly avoided that with the help of a really good doctor, really good physical therapist. But, you know, a lot of times physical symptoms when you're less than your best can manifest or create some mental symptoms. So just like the physical injury, you know, I ended up just becoming very depressed. There were a lot of things I couldn't do. I went from working out every day and being able to deadlift and you know, just spend a couple hours in the gym to not really being able to do much of anything. And I was getting really bad headaches. It was literally depressing. And Yeah, it's, you know, I think another one of those moments where it's important for you to have someone to lean on, someone to talk to. But yeah, I just it's ironic that like that happened kind of immediately pre-COVID. I mean, most people, you know, life was great before COVID, then COVID hit, and you know, they end up in a kind of a bad spot with all the isolation and the kind of shelter in place and the lockdown and everything. It all happened before COVID for me, and then during COVID, I was actually in a really good place. So, yeah, it was a good 6-8 months where I just felt kind of lost, felt kind of useless, because I had so many physical limitations, and it ended up just getting the best of me emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned I had a physical therapist who was just fantastic. And thanks to him, I was able to avoid surgery narrowly. And, you know, he just kept saying to me, he's like, a lot of probably what caused the injury was just, you spend a lot of time as a writer sitting at your desk. Yeah, you know, you probably really tweaked your neck pretty bad when you're deadlifting, but I don't think that's what caused it. I just think that was kind of the, you know, the final straw. You say it's your posture and just spending so much time sitting in front of a computer, looking at a screen, punching over, whatever it might be. Is that you need to keep your chin up and your chest out, and you just need to improve your posture.
Boom.
And chin up, chest out became my mantra. You know, it's kind of how I, in my self-talk, to get in a better place. And it's interesting when you do adjust your body language, you become a little bit more present and notice sort of how you're showing up, how that does affect your mindset. And I just thought it's a great metaphor for how you ought to navigate life, and decided to create a clothing brand around that, chin up, chest out apparel. And it's just kind of interesting how ideas germinate in our heads, right? But that mantra is probably what ended up helping me more than anything else, you know, both physically and emotionally. And I just started signing off on all my emails and, you know, phone calls with that sort of slogan. And it just grew legs and got traction, and people started kind of parroting that back. So, you know, we do hats and t-shirts and some other apparel to kind of have like your own advertising campaign about what you need to do to keep your mind right, keep your attitude straight.
Yep. Oh, I love it, brother. Great, great hinge moment, man, for sure. Appreciate you sharing that. You talked about in the big book of Brew, this one right here.
It's huge, huge.
It is huge, man.
That's what Trump called it. Trump called it huge. Bigly.
Number 162 is talk about be deaf. You talked about your daughter is deaf, and in some ways it's a competitive advantage. We don't hear the negativity. Talk to us about that one, that lesson.
So, you know, we were very fortunate that we moved from Maine to North Carolina before she was born. Had my daughter been born in Maine, there's no newborn hearing screening in the state at the time that she was born. This is in 2004. So she was born in North Carolina. She failed her newborn hearing screening. And that's when, you know, we immediately knew something was up. So what felt like something terrible, again, hinge moment, something terrible to me, like, oh no, she's she lacks one of her five senses. How is she going to navigate the world being deaf? How is, like, this is just going to really slow her development socially, emotionally, academically, the whole thing, like just catastrophizing everything in my mind. And there was one evening where I am cleaning off her high chair. She had like one of those plastic clip-on trays that go on like a kid's high chair as an infant. And I wipe it down with a wet towel and I dry it off. And she's tapping on the tabletop. And like, like, yeah, I just cleaned it off. What do you need, honey? And she just points at this one speck in the corner where there's a grain of salt that apparently I missed, a single grain of white table salt on this white plastic tray. And that's when the light bulb went on for me. Like, oh, a lot of times our adversity is our advantage in life. And when you're lacking in one of your five senses, your other senses are elevated. Mm-hmm. So like it was kind of from that moment on, I knew she had amazing attention to detail. You know, just visual acuity is off the charts. And she's been just fine. You know, she's a 20-year-old sophomore in college, doing really well academically. Like all those worries we had, you know, early on, the things we worry about versus the things that come to fruition are often very different. But I just look at that anytime like something bad happens, you know, as terrible as things can be, like there's got to be some good in there somewhere. Like what's the message for us that we're trying, that someone's trying to teach us, you know? And in that case, it was your other senses are heightened. And you know, we saw that also early on, just being involved in the deaf community. Our friend's son is profoundly deaf, can't hear at all. My daughter is hearing aid. She has some of her hearing. She's a moderate to severe hearing loss, but my friend's son is profoundly deaf. It's one of the best swimmers, one of the best high school swimmers in the state. And like, how do races start, Rob? Swim meets.
The gun.
With a gun, right? Yeah. Well, there's also a light at the end of the pool, and the gun is supposed to be synchronized with the go light. Well, what travels faster, sound or light?
Light.
The speed of light is faster than the speed of sound. So he couldn't hear the gun. Everyone else is responding to the gun. He's looking forward. He's got his eyes up, looking forward, responding to that light going on. And he's off the blocks and into the water faster than many more talented swimmers. So like his adversity became his advantage. And, you know, if you look closely enough in your own life, you will find moments and, you know, situations like that where, you know, you think that you have something that's a bit of a challenge or a struggle, or you're in some way handicapped in your business, maybe. It could actually be an advantage if you look even closer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it, man. Love your stories, man. Dialed in, bud. Let's keep it rolling. Coach Brew, the Lasso Way, talk to us about what was the impetus, the inspiration behind, you know, the leadership principles you put in this one.
Well, I will tell you this. If you are listening to this podcast and you have not watched Ted Lasso yet, or you think that seems dumb, I don't want to watch that, or I'm not into soccer or whatever, like I don't like Jason Sudeikis, whatever you're thinking, trust me on this. I felt the exact same way in my mind. I was saying all those things. I had a dozen people recommend Ted Lasso to me. And I'm like, nah, it doesn't sound like that's for me. One of my close friends who is an awful lot like me, and I'm not a big soccer fan. You know, if you're going to play 90 minutes and the score is going to be 0-0 and then you go home, like, I question all your life choices if you set up a game with rules like that, you know. But one of my close friends said, hey, I was watching Ted Lasso. I thought of you. You know, I didn't think I was going to like it. I end up really loving it. I think you would love it. I said, all right, Chris. Shout out, Chris Fitzpatrick. I said, all right, I'll watch it. So I started watching it. And I'm like, this is not necessarily even really a show about soccer. In a way, it's not even about sports. It's about the human condition. It's about human relations. So my motivation to write the book was really, if I had like a professional mulligan in life and I could go back and start my coaching career over again, I would want to be more like Ted Lasso. And I, you know, used basically, you know, 10 chapters that describe just sort of you know, the human relations skills that he uses to navigate this new team that he's coaching in a foreign country and a sport that's really kind of foreign to him. I'm not going to spoil it for anybody. Also, the book does not spoil the television series at all, and that was by design. There's a huge warning on the first page where I intentionally don't reveal specific examples from any of the episodes because I don't want to spoil the show for you. And if all you can do is afford to rent Apple TV long enough to binge the series or to buy my book, don't buy my book, watch the series. Like, that's how much I was really just moved and influenced by it. You should use the book as kind of a companion to the series. But you know, it's interesting. We started this podcast talking about how, like, really we're all in the relationship business. You know, you're not necessarily in the coaching business or the teaching business or whatever. You know, you're the insurance business, real estate. You're in the relationship business. And more than anyone, I understand it's a fictitious character and a fictitious, you know, TV show. Like, I get that. But more than anyone, there's so much reality injected into this show. And more than anyone, Ted Lasso really exhibits the relationship skills that we should all possess as leaders. And I wanted to capture them. And that's really what I did in this short, pretty concise, hard-hitting book. And there are a couple of bonuses at the end. You know, he brings his boss these homemade.
I was going to talk about that one.
Okay, we'll cover that later. But right. It's really me writing about the coach I wish I would have been, and using Ted Lasso as sort of the playbook for that.
So you were about to give it away, but I mean, we can talk about this. Like, one of the, you know, again, with the British culture and their affinity for biscuits, cookies, as we would call them here.
Yeah.
Ted Lasso's biscuits with the boss recipe. How'd you find the recipe? And I mean, I'm looking forward to actually doing that, man. Talk to us about that one.
Yeah, so this isn't a spoiler. One of the things Ted does to try and build a relationship with the owner of the team is he brings this little pink box that has four shortbread cookies. They call them biscuits. It's just four shortbread cookies in it. And he just plunks it on her desk every morning, first thing in the morning when he gets to work. And she'll have her tea and eat those cookies. And she found it really annoying. And his whole idea was like, let's break bread together, literally, and talk about your vision, you know, for the ball club. And she didn't want to do that at all. And he said, okay, I'll just leave these cookies with you. And then he kept leaving them. She kept not wanting to talk. And eventually, because A, he was consistent, B, he was generous, and C, they were really good biscuits, he finally like wore her down against her better judgment. She's like, hey, you know, don't leave, sit down, let's talk one day. And that's when you really started to see them have progress, not just with their relationship, but with the organization. And I just think there's so much to be said for the informal moments that you have, you know, whether it's with a teacher and a student, a player and a coach, a manager and employee, whichever the case may be, as you're listening to this. You know, there's way more impact that you can have in those informal moments over a cup of coffee, some biscuits, a bagel, whatever, than in that like quarterly performance review or your end of the year, quote, formal meeting. And, you know, you like to say it's chess, not checkers. And Ted Lasso is a great example of that. He was playing chess on day one. He knew she might not eat him. He knew she might not want them. He knew she might not invite him to sit down, but he was playing the long game with that and just building that social equity that finally led to some breakthrough conversations. And that's something anyone can do in their workplace. They just need to find their own version of that.
Mm-hmm. Where did you find the recipe, mate?
I just found it online through like a Ted Lasso message board. It might've been like a Reddit thread. And there are a couple different variations, and all, you know how it is on Reddit. Like, all these people are just like bickering back and forth. No, this is the real one. No, this is, you're missing this ingredient. No, I'm not. Like, so I just kind of like sifted through that and like, okay, this one makes sense. Let me try making it. And it came out, I'm not a cook, and it came out pretty good. So I'm like, yeah, we're going to roll with that. It seems like the most factually accurate of the recipes.
Yeah. My daughter loves to bake. And I was always fascinated. This is a little tangent, Coach, but I was always fascinated by the sifting process. Because I was like, well, you just put it in there. Like, what could be the difference of actually sifting? But it makes a big difference, doesn't it? How do you think that one applies to life?
Well, I think that it can apply in a lot of ways. The way I think it might be most applicable is simply there is so much being thrown at us on a daily basis that a lot of people really have lost the ability to use discernment. And so whether it's sifting through data, sifting through all the stuff that gets thrown at you, you know, on your smartphone every day, your social media feed, your emails, to-do lists or whatever, you know, being able to sift out the garbage, you know, garbage in, garbage out, sift out the garbage and just focus on the meaningful, important things. I'm not sure if that's where you were going with sifting and baking as an analogy, but it's immediately what comes to mind for me.
I love it, man.
Want to listen to your favorite music, but you're sick of all the commercial interruptions and negative news today? Tune in to KukoRadio.com. Music for your mindset. We're a commercial-free online radio station, playing nothing but hits. Our free iOS and Android apps are available for download at KukoRadio.com.
Coach Brew, what question should I be asking that that I'm not asking?
What I think Ted Lasso's superpower is. And I'm glad you asked that, Rob. Well, I think that Ted Lasso's superpower is, he's got great human relations skills, but the superpower with that is he doesn't think he has all the answers and he's willing to listen to his players. And that's where, if I had that professional mulligan and I could go back, I would love to be a better listener. And, you know, people support a world they get to help create. And, you know, they when they have more like feedback and input, they're going to have more buy-in. And I just wonder if I was able to kind of use some of Ted Lasso's human relations skills a little better, how much more mileage I would have gotten on my team, how much closer my relationships would have been with some of my players. It might have been harder to reach. You know, the ability to go back and practice that would have been wonderful. But I think his superpower really is, you know, like he took the equipment manager who washed the uniforms and, you know, put out the cones at practice. He made him assistant coach. Why? The guy knew more about soccer than Ted Lasso and his, you know, assistant that he brought over from the U.S. because they coach American football. And just the willingness to put your ego on a shelf and accept feedback, accept constructive criticism, be open to ideas, I think is huge for anyone in any industry.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, I want to turn the tables on this interview and ask.
Oh, I don't know, but we're out of time. All right, go ahead, Coach.
What's a time where you initially might have discounted somebody's thoughts or feedback, but then you really kind of slept on it, thought about it, you know, and decided to use that input and were pleasantly surprised and got a wonderful result?
Oh, man, every day. Every day. I will, unfortunately, one of the pieces I've always tried working on is, I would hear something, receive something, and just automatically, like, because that's the way my mind works. Yeah. It just automatically kind of like dismisses it and say, well, that's kind of silly. Until I can kind of digest it and see, all right, what's the real message in there? And I think the reason why is because, let's look at the Michael Jordan quote, I've missed 10,000 shots, that's why I've made it. Well, that quote gets recirculated so much. Every time I come across it, I kind of get sick of it. You know, I'm like, I just, don't really want that quote anymore.
Is it a little out of context?
Well, no, the context works, but I guess that was my thing. So to answer the question, so often when I receive information, I need to let it sit there. And then I think about it and then I come back to it. It's the only way my mind is able to discern, all right, well, what is really truth? What's the angle here, the approach that can work?
Yeah.
I've been blessed with like a good memory, so I can remember things like that, but too often, I mean, so many of my ideas are, you know, borrowed from you, you know? And again, I'll give you attribution and keep the royalties on it, but, yeah, a lot of the stuff is borrowed. And I would think about like some of the techniques in terms of whether it's speaking or delivering a point or getting, something across in a novel way.
Sure.
So if that one answers the question.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're married and you have kids, you know, our wives and our kids, tend to be right way more than we realize. Oh, okay. And yeah, so when you said every day, I thought that's where you were going with it. But yeah.
Oh. Well, see, I can edit this since this is my podcast.
So it's kind of funny you say that because I got, you know, one of my friends and I exchanged just like funny memes, you know, on a daily basis via text. And I'm sending him like the Travis Kelce yelling at Andy Reid in the Super Bowl from a couple weeks ago meme and captioning it. And he sends me a meme of a prostitute like dressed up in high heels, short skirt, leaning into the passenger side of a car. And you're seeing it like from head on, you know, through the camera lens. And the guy's looking over at her and he's like, how much will it cost me for you to tell me I'm right?
Yeah.
So like clearly like his wife tells him he's wrong all the time because, well, yeah, usually we are wrong as husbands. So like he's going to hire a professional to just humor him and tell him he's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah, I think our spouses and our kids sometimes are our best teachers to kind of bring it back on track. When we digest the idea and we listen to their feedback.
Teachers and parents and coaches, like we point the finger, but they hold up the mirror.
Yep.
So, love that. Drew, thanks for joining us, man.
My pleasure. Thank you. This has been fun.
Listening to Mental Toughness with Dr. Rob Bell. To find out more about Dr. Rob, visit his website at drrobbell.com or follow him on Twitter at Dr. Rob Bell and subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform to get the next episode of Mental Toughness as soon as it's available. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.